brought to you in Development Radio Southern FM, where you hear nothing but great music. 88.3 Southern FM.
And we welcome you to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. Well, last Wednesday, history was made. The European Space Agency, with a bit of Australian help, placed its Rosetta spacecraft into a rendezvous station-keeping position just 100 kilometres from Comet 67P, Churyumov Gerasimenko. This was the first spacecraft in history to do so. On this evening's The Space Show, we will follow up on last week's two-hour space show with a description of how the first images of the detail of the comet arrived here on Earth. And, as promised, we have details of what NASA plans for its next Mars rover. Just as the Opportunity has passed the 40-kilometre mark, about the distance of a marathon, we'll find out what the next rover is going to do. But don't hold your breath. It won't be launched until 2020. Comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko is in an orbit ranging between 5.7 astronomical units and 1.25 astronomical units from the Sun. That's 850 million kilometres to 186 million kilometres. 1 AU is the distance between the Earth and the Sun, 150 million kilometres. It takes 6.45 years to complete each orbit. Now, in 2004, the European Space Agency launched the Rosetta spacecraft to rendezvous with and orbit this comet. Last Wednesday, the spacecraft achieved that rendezvous and began a series of complex manoeuvres that will place it into orbit around the nucleus by the end of September. Today, the comet and Rosetta are between the orbits of Jupiter and Mars. That's around about 544 million kilometres from the Sun. The comet is on the inbound leg of its elliptical path around the Sun. Perihelion will occur in 1 year's time. That's on 2015, August the 13th. At that time, it'll be 167 million kilometres from the Sun, between the orbits of the Earth and Mars. During that year, Rosetta will study how the coma and tail develop. Already, a small coma has developed and has been imaged by Rosetta. Now, after the show last week, we continued to monitor the events at the European Space Operations Centre in Darmstadt, Germany. And this is what Mark McCroyan had to say. He's the senior advisor at the Directorate of Science and Robotic Exploration with the European Space Agency, and he was informing us about how comets are made, what the objectives of Rosetta and Philae, the lander, are, and how images are manipulated, and what we knew at that time, up to that point anyway, of the comet. So we'll go over across now to Mark McCroyan at the European Space Operations Centre in Darmstadt, speaking Wednesday last week.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to European Space Operations Centre here in Darmstadt, where we saw this morning a fantastic event, the rendezvous of Rosetta with 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko, as I've christened it, the most crazy bonkers superstar comet in the solar system. We have won the gold medal with this comet, I think it's fair to say. It's an astonishing object. But of course, this is only the beginning. We've seen that we can get a comet, catch up with it, get close to it. But why would we want to do that? We want to do that because we want to do science. And this afternoon's session is going to describe some of the necessary technical steps in order to enable that science, but also what the core science goals are going to be. And I'm just going to start with an introduction. You can see my name is Mark McCorcoran. I'm the senior science advisor here in the Directorate of Science and Robotic Exploration at the agency. So what is Rosetta there to do? Well, it's there in a way, to unlock an icy treasure chest. Comets are leftover material from the birth of the solar system 4.6 billion years ago. They have dust, they have water, they have organic molecules. Unlocking a treasure chest of this kind will allow us to start investigating the evolution and the birth in that order, the birth and evolution of our own solar system, and the cycle of material from former generations of stars into dust and gas that get reprocessed into new generations of stars and planetary systems, and also into life, potentially. The complex organic molecules I told you about are on the surface of comets. We know, for example, there's glycine on at least one comet, and now we'll start doing that kind of work in way more detail at 67 PCG. And also the question of the origin of water. The water on the planet that you've been drinking here in your coffee or in your healthy drinks over lunchtime, where did that water come from? One theory has it that the Earth was very hot when it was very young, no water on the surface of the Earth, and that water must have been delivered by something else later on, potentially comets. But do we have the ratios, the isotopic ratios, right for that to be the case? So we need to investigate that scientifically. And if I zoom in and look at a protoplanetary disk in this early phase, as material was agglomerating, forming into little balls of material, the comets were effectively left over. Most of them in the outer solar system where it was colder. Some of those have migrated into the inner solar system, like 67 PCG, and some are way, way out there in the Oort cloud, the comets out at almost halfway to the nearest stars. So this primordial material that's left over is what we're going to go and investigate and try to unlock these origins questions, which are fascinating to everybody. And that's where we are today, 100 kilometers away. But in the end, we'll be 10 kilometers and even closer as we skim over the surface and put the lander down. We're there to do science. And so with the orbiter, we have a range of instruments, some of which you're going to hear about this afternoon, which have results already, some of which you'll be hearing about over the coming months as we now dig in detail. But from a distance with the orbiter, we're going to image, we're going to take pictures in multiple wavelengths from the ultraviolet all the way through to radio wavelengths with the visible in the middle. We're going to be capturing material in the coma around the comet and doing mass spectroscopy. We have a little laboratory on board to actually investigate dust and gas particles. We're actually going to look at them in detail with microscopy as well. With these instruments, we're going to measure the plasma, the ionized gas, which is around the comet as well. And then when the lander descends to the surface, hopefully in November this year, we again have imaging during the descent and a surface panorama, some of which is in 3D. We will be measuring the material in situ now, providing in one location on the comet great detail, which we then can extrapolate to the rest of the comet from our remote sensing. And then we'll actually drill into the surface, 23 centimeters down, pull material up, and investigate that material in a little laboratory on board. We also link the two, the lander and the orbiter, together with low-frequency radio waves to investigate the interior, to take a tomographic picture, a bit like an MRI of the inside of the comet. And then we're going to beam signals back to Earth, and we're going to measure tiny deviations in those signals, and that will tell us about the gravitational field of the comet. For those of you who haven't got a byline for tomorrow, the one thing that did strike us when we were looking at these pictures, it is a Klingon bird of prey, isn't it? It has got the wings, so it's partially cloaked, but it's a remarkable object, and you're going to see a lot more of it this afternoon. Every time we see a picture of this comet over the last few weeks, I mean, remember when our jaws were dropping when there were just 3 pixels, 20 pixels, 100 pixels, every time the images came and were put out there, the NavCam images and the Osiris images, you know, jaws dropped, and it just hasn't stopped yet. But of course, it's not just all about the imaging, because we want to get onto the surface with other instruments and try to look at the slight gradations in color, in composition, in the kinds of materials that are there. I mean, one thing to take away from this image, again, for everybody who's not, you know, been close to this, so to speak, we've stretched this image so that the brightest point in the image is white and the darkest point is black. I mean, it's fairly logical. But keep in mind that the real comet is actually blacker than anything I'm wearing here. It's blacker than fresh asphalt. So when we talk about colors, it really has very little meaning in that sense. They're incredibly dark gray objects. We can tease out a little bit of color difference, but if you start seeing gaudy color pictures of the comet, they're not real. They're scientific representations to bring out information. So I think we probably could have got away with it this morning if we actually just showed a completely black screen and said, that's the comet. And we wouldn't have been wrong at some level. because this screen is not as dark as the comet really is. You know, these are a few percent, and the comet is a few percent in reflectivity. And again, we want to go and look at the details, the materials. We look at a grayscale image like this, we don't really immediately know, is there ice? Is there dust? Which areas? I mean, we've kind of christened this area here the Chamonix ski resort right here. It looks a bit like that. One of the whiter areas. Again, very dark in reality, but brighter than other areas. Is that more of a slight abundance of ice there than there is in other areas? And then we see areas which seem to be very smooth. And maybe they're somehow at the active areas. And we'll see some images you saw on this morning showing jets coming out from the nucleus. And that, of course, is another story. It's not just about the nucleus. It's about the activity and how material is driven off into the coma and how that material flows out into a tail, which will be next year, not at the moment. We have a coma now, but we don't have a tail. We're not close enough to the sun. So really, again, this is just the beginning. It's the gateway to all the science that's going to come from all the other instruments, including the imaging instruments, of course. And that's in the next 3 months, not only doing science, but preparing for the landing event. And the one way to think about this is even to attempt a landing, we will have had a huge success on this mission, because we cannot attempt a landing without understanding the comet very well. So when you're all back here in November, hopefully, and we run that landing, remember that we've been very successful by that point. And we will be afterwards, because what we want to do, of course, is follow this comet as it evolves. We're landing now, we're approaching, rendezvousing, landing now, when the comet's actually very boring. We want to do that. It's far from the sun. We don't want to be in an operationally dangerous position. And we also want to measure the comet when it's not active, so we can compare that to when it's more active and so on. So this is a baseline now that we're taking scientifically. You know, there's a huge amount to come in the next few months ahead of landing. But next year also is going to be an enormous adventure, all the way through perihelion in August next year, all the way through to at least the end of next year, December, as we start coming back out of the inner solar system. Keep in mind also that a lot of people say, well, when we get to perihelion, it'll be super dangerous and a terrible place to operate. And, well, we don't go that close to the sun. We're at 184 million kilometers at the closest approach. That's not even as close to the sun as the Earth. So this is a good comet to actually be safe with as well. It's going to be active, but it's not going to be that dangerous.
During the approach to the comet, Rosetta took photos of the nucleus, which turns out to be a complex duck-like shape. Now, Rosetta last week passed within 100 kilometers of the nucleus and has begun detailed mapping of that nucleus. To mark this close pass, the European Space Agency made an exception to its data release policy and revealed the latest picture last Wednesday. Now, normally, data are stored on board Rosetta and only downlinked a few days later. Scientists then have up to 6 months to analyze the data before publishing their findings. Well, there was great excitement at the European Space Operations Centre in Darmstadt as the pictures were received. Larry O'Bork, who works in science operations in Spain, but was at Darmstadt for this event, shared the excitement with us.
Yeah, Leo Enright from Irish Television. Larry, I'm sorry, I'm going to embarrass you with a how do you feel question, but you and I first met 12, 13 years ago in a clean room in bunny suits, looking at this spacecraft. You've been with it on and off ever since. How did it feel for you personally this morning when it finally arrived? What did it feel like?
Well, it's certainly personally, it's something which I've been waiting for such a long time, to put so much energy and enthusiasm in the mission. Not only myself who's been doing this, but of course the team here in ESOC, the team in Spain. It's an achievement. This is not an easy mission. We don't do it because it's easy. We do it because we're trying to extract the best science from all the countries involved. It's been a long time. It's been 10 years. We both got older, certainly better looking. But it's clear that this morning we hit a milestone, an important milestone in this mission. But this mission isn't just about arriving at a comet. It's about studying the comet. It's about placing a lander in a comet. But again, the mission does not end there. The science continues. We're trying to follow this comet all around its orbit. We're going to study a comet live in view, well, relive every moment as it releases its coma. And we're doing it together with, of course, all of you who'll be looking over our shoulders. And we're very happy to share it with you. Certainly, I'm personally very happy to share it with you.
Over the coming weeks, Rosetta will make a series of ever closer passes of the comet before finally orbiting it. Andrea Accomazzo is the flight director for the mission, and he had these comments to make about the approach that would be happening.
We're now going to go to Andrea Accomazzo, the flight director, who's going to give us a little bit of a wrap-up on where we go next. We'll have some Q&A, and then we can... Andrea.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks to everybody, and thanks to Olga for the nice words. It's a bit difficult now to say what the emotions are. It's very deep into all of us. Frank presented already earlier on what are the challenges in front of us. We have to map this object. It's known to the level you have seen in the images. We need to know much more to go on. I said earlier today that it's like having been driving a car or a bus on a motorway for 10 years. Now we have entered downtown. We are downtown, and we have to start orienting ourselves. We don't know the town yet, so we have to discover it first thing. We're not driving a car, we're driving a bus. You have seen how big Rosetta is. It's more like a bus. In this bus, we have 20 instruments, take 5 scientists per instrument. It's more than 100 people, 100 scientists, 300 opinions as a minimum. So I'm very grateful to Larry and the team down in ISAC that act as mediators to us. So what it comes to us is a bit mediated down. So we have to put all this together. It's not enough. We want to land on this object. So it's not even a car. We are more like an airplane. We have to find a landing strip here. So this is the major task we have in front of us right now. So we are collecting information to get closer to the comet, to increase by a factor 10 the resolution on the surface, to allow Stefan, I think he has left in the meanwhile, to select a landing site. We have to learn how to fly around this object. Olga, where are you? Don't try to ask us to fly through the gorge that we see in the comet. I know you. And I also want to spend a couple of words for people that have made all this happen. Everybody's very grateful to us that we are conducting operations right now. But this mission was conceived 30 years ago by V.R. Gerhardt. Hans as well, I think you were in the team and the meeting where in 85 was someone had the brilliant idea of flying to a comet. It took 10 years to convince ourselves this was the idea was more than brilliant, we could implement it. 10 years to build the spacecraft, 10 years to get there, and now I think we will have more than 10 years to exploit all the science these people will dig out of this comet. So this is what we have in front of us. For us, operations is an extreme challenging time. It's extremely tense. As from tomorrow, we start navigating close to this object. We start tomorrow morning, 5 o'clock, processing images to know where the spacecraft is after the maneuver to check the performance of the maneuver. And every Monday, every Thursday from now onwards, we'll do it throughout the mission. We are getting closer to the lander. This will increase further the intensity of operation here. This is what we have to master here, and this is what we have prepared for 10 years. So now we are ready to go. Thanks a lot for your attention, and if there's any question, I'm pleased to answer.
Thanks very much, Andrea.
One of the instruments aboard Rosetta is the visible infrared and thermal imaging spectrometer, otherwise known as VIRTIS, V-I-R-T-I-S. Now, during mid-July, VIRTIS took measurements of the heat radiation coming from the comet, and as the spacecraft closed in from 14,000 to just over 5,000 kilometres, it sent the information back towards the Earth. The infrared sensor showed that the average temperature of the comet 67P is around about negative 70 Celsius. This means that much of the surface must be dusty rather than bare ice. A bare ice comet would be a lot colder than negative 70 Celsius. Well, our next speaker talks about this instrument and the international collaboration that was involved in it. This is Fabrizio Capaccioni, the principal investigator of the VIRTIS. He comes from INAF, IAPS, which is in Italy, and the Roman part of Italy.
I would like to welcome up on stage, you saw him this morning, Fabrizio Capaccioni, the PI, the principal investigator for the VIRTIS instrument, and he's going to explain to you what that is, how it works.
Okay, thank you very much. Yes, VIRTIS is an acronym, which stands for Visible Infrared and Thermal Imaging Spectrometer, which doesn't say it all, because it's this is the major task of one of the two channels. There are two channels in the instrument, and we will see in a moment. We have been working on the instrument since 94, so it's... The science team is composed of about 50 people, 50 persons, 50 scientists from 18 institutes and universities from Europe and also United States, Poland, Italo-Franco-German endeavor. It's a 30-kilogram object, which is composed of two channels. VIRTIS-M, which is the mapper, M stands for mapper, which is effectively the imaging spectrometer. As we can think of it as a camera which, instead of having three filters, three colors, covers a wider range of colors, 860 bands, in fact, going from the ultraviolet to the thermal infrared. And that has allowed to produce maps of the composition of the surface and thermal properties of the surface. And then we have VIRTIS-H. H stands for high resolution, and this is a point spectrometer. It's not doesn't have imaging capabilities, but has a very fine spectral resolution in 3,000 bands. So we can really understand the composition of the coma volatiles. In fact, this is the distinction between the two. VIRTIS-M will be mainly devoted to the surface, to the nucleus, and VIRTIS-H to the coma. But of course, their role is interchangeable. And then there is another important aspect, because VIRTIS-M is built in Italy, VIRTIS-H in France, and the electronics, the digital electronics that drive all the instrument, has been built in Germany by DLR in Berlin. What is important that this instrument, looking at the right wavelength and showing a picture at the right wavelength, gives you the map of the distribution of that compound on the surface. There are two interesting things here. One, the large temperature, again, points to a surface which is certainly devoid of volatiles, because there are no volatiles that can remove heat. Porous, because the thermal conductivity through the first layer is limited. That is why we have such large temperature. And also it's pointing out, as you are seeing, there is a modulation of the temperature here. This is speculation, of course, but there are differences which can point to either illumination differences in the various region, or compositional, or differences in physical properties. But this is speculation for the moment. There is a last point which I think is important, and is correlated to the fact that the Rosetta mission is not an ensemble of instruments working by themselves, but it's important that all the instruments try to work together to understand the behavior of how the comet behaves. And this is an example, a very clear example of the study, again, of the thermal properties, but this is valid also for composition and for other aspects. There are information that have to be shared, which are acquired by different type of instrument. For instance, the surface temperature is controlled by rugosity, by the roughness of the surface. And this can be measured by Osiris, down to meter or even decimeter scales. And on the two instruments on board of the lander, which are going down to millimeter scale. So we can study roughness by this means. Then VIRTIS and the experiment MUPUS on the lander will measure the temperature in the top few micron. And this is an important information. Then the temperature, again, the behavior of the structure is driven by the heat transport, is driven by the thermal conductivity, the porosity, and the density. And this is something that, again, is measured by MUPUS and another experiment on the lander, SESAMI. And then finally, the two experiments, MIRO and MUPUS, can measure the temperature down to few tenths of centimeters. So altogether, they will provide a clear picture of the structure of the first alpha meter of the surface, and how the heat is exchanged, and what kind of physical properties we have on the surface. So this is important. I think it's, as you said there, it's a synergistic approach, which is important.
I think that's a great point for us to jump over in the interest of time. Thank you very much, Fabrizio.
Last Wednesday evening, our Australian Eastern Time, the thrusters on Rosetta fired to make the craft begin to follow a series of triangular arcs. Each of these arcs will be about 100 kilometres long. Now, Rosetta will make a small thruster burn at each apex to swing over to the next arc and stay near the comet. Now, each arc will take about 2 to 3 days. The path will make an approximate equilateral triangle with the comet at the centre. During August and into September, the height of these arcs will be steadily lowered. At 100 kilometres from the comet, the gravity of the nucleus is too weak to capture Rosetta into orbit. Once Rosetta goes below an altitude of 30 kilometres, it will be captured into orbit, provided its speed relative to the nucleus is less than human walking speed. I say relative because both the comet and the spacecraft will be travelling at some 55,000 kilometres per hour in their orbits around the Sun. Now, Frank Budnick works in flight dynamics at the European Space Operations Centre, and he had this description of the approach and orbit to the comet and the orbit around it.
Frank Budnick from flight dynamics here at ESOC, and he's going to give you a little bit of a talk now, and he's going to do a little bit of an intro into some of the key issues now about what we're doing next. What happened this morning? What that rendezvous maneuver was? There it is. So, Frank.
We are in a kind of triangular shape orbit in front of the comet, as seen from the Sun. And each of these edges here is actually maneuver. So we do now maneuver every Wednesday and every Sunday to change this shape. And then once we have flown this triangle, we go closer to about 50 kilometers and we do the same triangle again. It slightly bended the trajectory relative to the comet, and we use this information to get hold on the mass of the comet. This we need to know, the mass of the comet, to get into orbit around the comet. And this is what we actually see here now. So this is the first transition into an orbit, which we just actually fly only half of it when we turn the plane of the orbit. So this is the orbital plane because we want to avoid going onto the night side, because then we cannot see the surface of the comet anymore, which we need to do. And then this is one of the first closed orbits. So this is what we, is the next phase after this initial characterization where we fly this triangular orbit. And this is what we call the global mapping. So we want to map the surface, and the intention is to map it to by about 80% of it. And then after a while, we go even closer. So we make a maneuver where we go closer. We have an orbit, elliptical orbit of about 10 to 30 kilometers. And then we do another maneuver here to go into a almost circular orbit with a distance of about 10 kilometers. And this is then what we call the close observation phase. And this is necessary to identify landing spots which have been selected before, what are suitable for landing, and to drop the lander finally in November. We are staying just in front of the comet to look at it, to characterize it, to measure its mass, to see landmarks, to characterize its rotation, to get to know the comet in more detail. And this is a necessary step before we can get any closer. We fly this triangle twice. And after this, we insert this into the orbit. When we get to know the mass much better, we can design an orbit around the comet, and we know how it rotates. We can also design the plane of the orbit. This is a suitable orbit because at this time we expect that the comet is more and more outgassing, and this outgassing is causing a big problem for us for navigating the spacecraft, because it's a force on the spacecraft. It pushes it away, and it's difficult to predict. So what we do here, we put the spacecraft such that the solar rays, this is the biggest part on Rosetta, that they are facing to the Sun and they are edge on to the flow from the comet dust. So we try to minimize the drag effect on the spacecraft. And this is why the main reason why we prefer to have orbits which are, let's say, in the terminator plane. Okay, this minimizes the effect of the drag. This is the cause of it. And we can stay there as long as we like, or as long as it's necessary to characterize the spacecraft sufficiently to go to the next step, to go closer. So then we do the maneuvers that we say, okay, we make a maneuver which is then 20 times 30 kilometer, and then 10 by 10. And finally, there's also this final maneuver where we say, okay, now we make a trajectory where we fly to 5 kilometer distance, drop the lander, make a maneuver to escape and to come back to get contact to the lander again once it has landed. So this is the current plan. This is for November. But we have to adapt the plan as what we get to learn in the next 3 months.
Now, depending on the activity of the nucleus, mission controllers may decide to make Rosetta orbit as close as 10 kilometres. On last week's The Space Show, we brought you the arrival of Rosetta at its 100-kilometre waypoint. This evening on Southern FM, we are relating what happened later that evening. Holger Sioux is the principal investigator for the OSIRIS camera that would return the much-anticipated first close-up images of the comet. The data containing the images began to arrive by radio link via the new NORSIA tracking station in Western Australia. Sioux explained the imaging sequence and the mission calendar used to determine the order of events.
I think we're ready now to jump over to Holger Sioux in the PISA room, where he's looking with his team at the data which came down overnight. So, Holger, there you are. Very good.
Hi, Mark. So we are preparing for the high-resolution images this afternoon. So the images in high-res we have shown this morning, they came down on Monday, and they were taken from 250-ish kilometer distance. So we are prepared for the day of arrival. So we have an imaging sequence on board that gets downloaded with priority. So it was taken this morning, and so we are receiving these images, and we are prepared to show them this afternoon. So I'd like to introduce you a little on what we are doing here in the PISA, the PI support area. So I want to show you our mission calendar, basically. So this is what we are doing. So you get a short view on from which sequence the images of today are going to be taken. Carsten.
Yeah, so right now we are operating the sequence, which we internally call Phase 40, which is several stations over the whole night. We started yesterday at 11, and we are running that station, that sequence right now. And we should be receiving data from this sequence these minutes.
Perfect. So it looks like a quite crowded calendar. So there's a lot of data coming down, and we gave some of these images priority to get downlinked now for the arrival event. Pablo, you know more details of the images that got into the priority queue. So could you tell us what is in there?
Yeah, so here we have a detail account with a second precision what commands go when, and we see that the last command in this sequence was acquired at 6:47 this morning, and on this screen here, we see here this packet counter shows us the images that are coming down right this minute. Of course, these images are very detailed, and they're big in data volume. This means it takes a certain amount of time to come down, but certainly this afternoon we will have fresh images to show to everybody.
Wonderful. Looking forward to seeing them. So remember, the spacecraft is a good 400 million kilometers away. It has to send the data down. The downlink is kilobit per second, so I don't know, 60, 70, depending on what antenna we are on. And we have megapixel images, full frames, that are coming down right now. So it takes a while to get these images transferred to ground such that we can process and share them with you. So a short view on what to expect for this afternoon in terms of illumination conditions. So how does the nucleus look like right now, so today at the time of arrival? JB can show us the shape model in rotation and today's illumination conditions. So this is what we will see. JB.
Yes, exactly. So this is a simulation of what we expect to see from the sequence that we just acquired. Showing exactly what our camera sees in the same condition of illumination as are now in reality. And we expect to see very nice images of this bottom part of the comet with a high resolution view of what's going on there. And also later, if we get all the images down, we should have a nice view of the neck region and maybe of this overhang here where the head meets the rest of the body of this nice comet.
Perfect. Thank you very much. So looking forward to getting these images unpacked, then really put together from spacecraft packets into raw images with auxiliary data, housekeeping temperature, all that engineering stuff, and then processing it. So we have to calibrate the images first and then get them over to you as soon as we can, Mark. So I hand back over to you.
Thank you very much, Holger. And just to remind everybody, JD showed you there the rotation Of course, the comet takes 12 hours to rotate. So, you know, it's not instant. You can't see that all of it at one time, and depending on the trajectory, as Frank showed you. And the other thing is, of course, and we're going to hear in a moment, it's not the only instrument on board. So he's having to share bandwidth with everybody else. And it's not a lot of bandwidth, as you appreciate. It's an antenna, you know, a few meters across, beaming down to big antennas on the ground, but it's 400 million kilometers away. So it's, I don't know which year, you'd probably have to go back to your household internet account and, you know, figure out the bit rate. But as he says, it's kilobits per second.
Later, aware that we were eager to have our first detailed view of the comet, CERCS gave a progress report from the Image Processing Laboratory.
We're going to move on now. We're going to go back to Pisa room and see where Holger is. He should have been frantically working away and getting a bit more images. So, Holger, how are you doing? Is it good? Going well?
Yes, we are doing well, so I think we have good news for you this afternoon. So let me go straight to the engineering screen to Pablo, telling you where we are with the downlink of these high-resolution images. Pablo.
Hi, Holger. We have received three images with zero packet loss. So okay. The images made it to ground safe and sound, two NAC high-quality images plus one WAC context image to know what we're talking about.
Perfect. So there is something to show that came down by a priority queue. This was a very smart call to go for. So we are reducing the data, calibrating the data. So what is needed, Carsten, to calibrate the images such that we can show them to the audience this afternoon?
Yeah, so I have the first NAC image here, and I'm working on this and I'm correcting the bias levels. I'm checking for hot pixels and that stuff. And it already looks amazing, but in a couple of minutes, I think we'll have a beautiful image.
Okay, wonderful. So there are news to share. We are also preparing zoom-ins to show you to you in a few minutes. So JB is working on zoom-ins such that we can share the higher resolution stuff that we see on the surface. So it's all about surface this today, so this afternoon. And, well, we'll come over as soon as we have the data ready for you, Mark.
Thank you very much, Holger. I think the thing, again, you need to point it out there. Well, Holger's left, but NAC, the narrow angle camera, is now effectively it's filling the field of view. It's the comet is now bigger than the field of view, so it's now all about the details on the surface. There is the wide angle camera, which will place the context. It's not that dissimilar to the field of view of the NavCam, so you'll be seeing wide angle pictures with the comet in the middle and the stuff around, and then zoom ins if you like. And this is at 100 kilometers. When we get into 50, 20, 10, we're going to be 10 times better. At least 10 times better than what you see coming even this afternoon. So this is not the biggest reveal, but it should be fantastic stuff.
Finally, after another quarter hour, an ebullient Holger CERCS came into the auditorium where officials and members of the press were being briefed on all aspects of the Rosetta mission. He triumphantly held aloft his laptop computer, on which was displayed an amazing image of the comet's nucleus.
The last speaker in this session, or the last scientist in the session, it's Holger CERCS, who's over there in the wings, principal investigator of the OSIRIS instrument. You've heard him from the PISA, where he was PISA room, where he's processing the data, and he now has, if he comes up on stage, or you're in the camera here, he has a laptop with him. Holger.
Well, this is a very, very emotional moment. Let me use a technical term and address it to Sylvain and Andrea. So from imagery, I can confirm we arrived. Yes, so this is the arrival image of taken by the OSIRIS narrow-angle camera from a good 100 kilometers distance. It came down, it was taken this night. It came down throughout this session, the arrival event today, and you see it as at highest resolution ever, first ever. So the resolution is here, the pixel resolution is 2.5 meters, and you see a lot of detail coming out here. So we see the bright areas, we see the head, we see the depression, and a lot of stuff laid out there. So we see the sides, so the body of the lower body of the nucleus, and a lot of detail. If you now let it rotate, you get a feel for the three-dimensional shape of this body. So let me see.
Now you see it. So it's three-dimensional. It's not a flat image. You see a lot of detail coming out by the shadows, a lot of boulders, even a family, a village of boulders coming up. Remember, these images, these boulders, they are house size. Whatever they are made of, we'll find out. So you see a lot of different topography. So so flat areas, smooth areas, cliffs of 100 meters size or so. And we'll have to find out what this is made of.
And these, again, were data from, this not the latest, to the ones from that we had this morning, if you like, more of the same, in the best possible sense.
So this is the backside, just a still image of the backside. So there's so much detail in there and so much news. So no one ever has been that close to a nucleus and has shown such high-resolution data. It's not about the nucleus alone. So we can expose, long exposure on the nucleus. These strips are artificial, so we have 100 times overexposure. We blow the nucleus like hell and work out the features. So we see a lot of activity already now, so far out, so far away from the sun. But we can do more. So we process the images. So this is a side view. You reckon this deep 1,000 meters deep depression. And we process the image using RGB image processing. So stretching from the near infrared via the orange band pass into the blue. And you see a lot more detail coming out. So this area, this bright area, is different from the compared to the environment. We have another way expressing this in green, so it's very nicely seen by us. So this is a cool area which we might want to link to activity. And here you go. This is really, really fantastic. That far out, see activity coming up, and link it to the source region on our nucleus. Well, coming back to the beauty shot, just processed. We want to zoom in, and I want to show you some details. Remember, these are now full frames, so you don't see the full detail even on this pretty screen. So where the zoom-ins are one-to-one, they are not really exploding. They are one-to-one images. So we want to have a look at this area here, and it's a zoom-in, a one-to-one zoom-in. This is really full detail of what we see. There's a lot of structure, so very smooth area, very nice stuff laying there on the surface. We see features we don't understand yet how this is created. A lot of overhang area here, so a big piece just connected to the head, and landscape. Cool. So we really arrived at the comet. So the second view, Pablo told you we have two images down. This is the bottom view now. So in highest res, you see the chunks up here and also in the flatlands. A lot of detail coming out and structures here from the downside of the head. This is really, really cool stuff. But also there, we want to zoom in. This is the village of boulders. And you see details of these boulders already now at arrival. So remember, we are at 100 kilometer distance. So we arrived, but we will get closer. And we see already now structures, long shadows on these stuff, which is just laying out there in the flatlands. And we are chatting when we look at it. So we have the impression something was flowing down there and just filling this or smoothing this area. This area obviously is smooth, but it has topography. So no clue what this is made from. It's the first view at it ever. Another side view on other structures. So there are very sharp edges. We see deep shadows. We see a lot of details all over the nucleus. And we'll learn in the coming months what this is telling us. And the last beauty shot So we can zoom in, work this, and we are really looking forward to even higher resolution. Imagine this is 100 kilometers from 10 kilometers, so we will have 10 times the resolution in X and Y. So the number density, the pixel density, will increase by even two orders of magnitude. This is really cool. That's what I wanted to show to you.
Great stuff, Holger. Thank you very much. And I think that applause counts for your team, for the team here, the guys in the audience, everybody that built this spacecraft years ago, some of whom are here and have been working on it.
Credits to the full Osiris team. So we are 82 people working on Osiris. So co-eyes, scientists, we have postdocs, technicians, engineers, students. So it's a huge team and it's really great. And we are very thankful. I mean, you made it happen. We built an instrument. You brought it there. So the applause really goes to you. So this is great, thank great stuff.
And if my German friend Holger will permit me, and he knows that I have a German wife, so that's fine. I'll paraphrase Winston Churchill, if I may. This is not the end. This is not the beginning of the end. It is the end of the beginning. And we are here, and I think we have this crazy bonkers Olympic gold medal winning comet to play with for the next year and a half, and it's fantastic stuff. So thanks, Holger.
Each day over the past week, the European Space Agency has released at least one new image of the nucleus of Comet 67P, Churyumov-Gerasimenko. And rest assured, the space show will be there at the landing in November.
Reaching into your community, the Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.